I guess trying to listen to myself talk, I've used the word support networks or support people a lot. And I think only now that I've articulated that do I realize how useful that support has been. One of the most telling examples was when I talked to my surgical mentor, one of my closest surgical mentors, about my change in career. I said to her, you know, that I was really worried about telling her that I was going to leave surgery, because I didn't want her to think that in all of the years she had spent helping me get onto the SET program, I didn't want her to think that she had wasted her time helping me and wasted her time training me. But when I told her that I was leaving, she said, you know, of course I don't think I've wasted my time. She said that she saw her role not as making me another version of her, but was helping me to become whatever version of myself I wanted to be.
Are you a health professional wanting to explore all the options life has to offer? Then you've come to the right place. The Balanced Medics Handover podcast is all about living outside the box of what we've been told. I'm Isabella, your host, a junior doctor from Australia and trained coach. I'll be interviewing health professionals from all walks of life, artists, authors, non-clinical specialists, and more. These stories show that our choices are endless. Let's take the journey together. This is The Handover. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Balanced Medics Handover podcast. This episode, we have Dr. Philippa Smith on. She is a Sydney-based doctor who has shifted from surgical training to medical admin. I'm really grateful to have Pip here today to share her story. It's so great to have doctors on who have changed from surgery to show everyone it's possible to change directions at any point in our careers. It's never too early. It's never too late. We're going to be talking all about this change, and we'll also speak a bit about motherhood and fertility in medicine. So without further ado, let's hand over to Pip. Hey, Pip, how are you?
Hi, I'm really well. Thank you, Isabella, and thank you for the invitation to be here today.
Thank you so much for being here. I know that in my own experience, I've had trouble finding someone from surgery who's willing to be on a podcast. So I'm really excited mm-hmm. that you could be here today. Now, can you share your journey in medicine and before medicine? Mm-hmm. How did you get to where you are now?
So I took a winding road to medicine. I had a previous career before deciding to do postgraduate med. So I grew up in Adelaide, very idyllic childhood in the Adelaide Hills, and was interested in science, in chemistry and biology. So I did undergraduate degrees in biochemistry in Adelaide. Then I actually moved up to Queensland to do a PhD in biochemistry in Brisbane at the University of Queensland, which was really interesting. But I found that academia and a career in academia wasn't really for me, that publish to perish, really cutthroat lifestyle of academia in a lot of ways wasn't really something I thought would be sustainable for me. So I was looking at other options about what to do. And as I was working through my PhD, I started doing more and more public interaction, public stakeholder stuff, representing my institute in various meetings and conferences, including doing recruitment for the university for academics and stuff. And that gave me a bit of a back-end view of how the university was running and the bigger picture policies and problems. And that led me thinking to, you know, how is science run in the background, which led me to pursuing a career in government. I moved from, after finishing my PhD, submitting my thesis, I moved to Canberra and worked for the federal government in Canberra at the Office of the Chief Scientist for Australia, initially under Professor Ian Chubb, which was super fun. We did a lot of work with 7 different prime ministers over my time.
Wow.
Working in the government, doing a lot of science policy, again, big picture, big issues, lots of really interesting stakeholders. And then, you know, I found through that work that I started becoming more curious about people as individuals and how people functioned, how people worked, how people thought, what people did. And I guess that narrowing of my curiosity then led me to pursuing medicine, which I did at ANU because I was in Canberra. So did my postgraduate degree at ANU, which was 4 years. And for my 4 years of med degree and my internship year, I still remained working part-time at the Office of the Chief Scientist because I just really loved both aspects of my life. And then after 8 years in Canberra, I decided Canberra was getting a bit too small and wanted to meet new people, try new things. If, for example, I was single at the time and the dating pool in Canberra is somewhat limited. So that led me to not that the dating pool wasn't the only reason to leave Canberra. I wanted to expand my career prospects and find mentors and new experiences in my career as well. And so that led me to applying to move to Sydney in the Sydney hospitals. And I landed at RPA for my resident year, which was amazing. And I stayed at RPA for 5 years until the end of last year. And through my time at RPA, I was working towards the surgical training pathway, or SET, as it is known through the College of Surgeons, and ended up having a bit of a wobble in my career aspirations last year, but still ended up getting accepted onto the SET program last year. However, because of that wobble, made me reconsider a few of my career choices and where I really wanted to go, and ended up at the same time as I was applying for SET entry, I applied for entrance into the College of Medical Administration. And for various reasons, which we'll probably touch on a bit later, decided to pursue medical administration instead. And that's where I am now. I'm a first year trainee, first year medical administration registrar, currently at the Medical Council of New South Wales, which is very different from the hospital life, very different from the surgical life, but I'm really enjoying it. And I don't have any regrets for how I got to where I am. And think everything I did in some ways leading up to now has helped me to get where I am. And although it was a bit of a winding, convoluted path, you know, it's made me who I am and has contributed to where I am with no regrets about how I got here.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And I love that it's your own winding path. It's not the straightforward one that you maybe are more accustomed to hear in medicine. And it's great that you can share it in that you started off big picture and you're coming full circle back to big picture med admin. And I'm really curious, because going from working in government and policy to aspiring to be a surgeon is such a big change. Mm-hmm. Why surgery initially?
Good question. I was like, surgery is just amazing. It's so fascinating. I think probably there's two key factors that drew me to surgery. And I think both of them, I can in some ways reflect how my childhood impacted those factors. You know, when I was a kid, I played sport endlessly. I was outside endlessly. You know, with my brother, with teams, with doing all sorts of different activities. And, you know, the two aspects I think that drew me into surgery firstly is the team aspect of it, that even outside of the operating theatre, a surgical team is so important, it's so critical. Everyone has a really well-defined role to play. In the team structure, even, you know, on a ward round, for example, the intern taking the notes is just as important as the fellow or the consultant talking to the patient. which it is in a lot of other medical teams, but you know, everyone knows how quickly a surgical ward round goes. If that intern doesn't take good notes, then there's a problem. Yeah. And similarly in the operating theatre, you know, it's a multidisciplinary team. There's nurses, anaesthetists, porters, who are just as important sometimes with flow in the operating theatre. There's the surgeon, and of course there's a patient. And through medical school, seeing how that team came together to work and to achieve a goal really, I guess, fed my background in sports and how, you know, that coaching and that we're in this together kind of aspect of surgery was really appealing to me and kind of sucked me in.
Yeah.
The other thing that attracted me to surgery, which I think a lot of surgeons like, is you see the results of what you're doing immediately right in front of you. You know, you reel a patient into theatre with cancer, and at the end of the operation, you reel them out of theatre and you've cut their cancer out. And, you know, if you've got the margins right and conditions are favourable, that patient no longer has cancer. And that's a really powerful thing to see happening right in front of you. And again, you know, growing up playing sports, like one of the sports I did was rowing. And if you worked harder, if you pulled the oar harder, you could immediately see that impact on the water. And I think that background really tied in nicely with what attracted me into surgery.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the teamwork aspect. And then, yes, I have heard the other one of that kind of, you can see the clear-cut results, part of the play on words, compared to, you know, medical specialties that are more chronic, right, and chronically.
Yeah.
I have more of a geriatrics background from my experience in hospital, which is a very, you know, different to surgical.
I think, you know, part of being a medical student that you get taught about is ruling things out as you go through. And I very quickly ruled out the things that, you know, just don't suit me and my personality. Like, I couldn't be a GP. I'd be a terrible GP. I don't have the patience, and I don't have the interest in breadth to be a GP, and similarly a geriatrician. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's so important, right? Not knowing what you don't want to do is like one of the most important things, and then you can start going into, okay, what actually is left and what do I like out of this. I wanted to know more about the process of applying to the surgical training program. So you said last year you applied and you had a wobble. I just want to know, was that your first time applying? How was the process for you?
So last year was the second time I applied. So the first year I applied was 2022, and I got kicked out in the first round, which meant there's various hurdles you have to pass to get into set selection, to fulfill the set selection criteria. So in 2022 was my first time I was offered an interview, but then I was cut at the first cut of the interview candidates as being unsuccessful. So then which was obviously disappointing, because it's a lot of work pulling the curriculum, your CV together, doing the prep for interviews long before you're even told if you have an interview or not, going through the interview process, and then to be told, you know, you're not good enough from the beginning. It hit to the ego, and it was like, you know, what's wrong with me kind of questions. But I managed to reach out to a lot of really great mentors at work and in life, and they encouraged me to apply again, and which I did in 2023 with a better CV, scored myself an interview, and then scored myself a place. So I guess the process itself, you know, it's hard, firstly, on purpose. It's complex. It's expensive. It's really expensive to do all of the prerequisites, you know, to sit the GSSE exam, I think is about $4,000 now, to do the courses that help you, you know, with interview prep, or the courses that RACs look favorably on in your CV. Is expensive, and I think a lot of people don't understand or don't realize how expensive it actually is. And it's certainly not really taken consideration by the college, I think. And it takes a lot of lead-in time. The three things that they look for in your CV are publications, it's teaching, and it's rotations. And, you know, everyone knows publications take ages to get. And you need people and senior people to look up to you, to sponsor you, to do that research. The teaching stuff you get points for. It takes a long time to build those relationships with the universities, for example, to allow you to do the appropriate teaching hours. Like, you have to do a certain set hours per week. And similarly, the rotations, you know, you get extra points for doing rural rotations. You have to do a certain number of ED, ICU rotations among the surgical requisites. And the other hard, very frustrating thing is that the College of Surgeons, and I know they're not alone in this, change the criteria, and they can change the criteria and with almost immediate effect. And keeping on top of that as a trainee and making sure that you're doing the best you can to fulfill what are the current criteria and in staying on top of what might be the next criteria is really tricky, and requires a lot of support, not just from senior mentors, but from other people at the same level, I think, and really talking about it and counselling each other through those different processes.
Yeah, from one of my best friends is in a neurology training, and I've been with her along the way, and hearing the changing rules, and now even the actual training itself, once on the program, it's changed as well. It's not a set number of years. So it is interesting to see the changes. And I can cut this out, by the way, if you don't want to talk about it. What was the wobble for you?
So the wobble for me started probably towards the end of 2022, where I was thinking about my career and my life goals and where I was really seeing myself. I think through, am I allowed to say the dirty C word of COVID?
But you're allowed to say COVID, yes.
And, you know, through the COVID pandemic, I know a lot of people and a lot of my colleagues and friends and family, it was a time of reflection for a lot of people and thinking about, you know, what was really important, because it was really scary at times. And, you know, I certainly stopped and reflected, wait a sec, what's important for me? What do I really care about? And what do I want for my life? And I think, you know, once the scary adrenaline rush of COVID started to peter out in 2022, it gave me time to sort of sit back and assess those thoughts a little bit more. And then I went on this really great holiday in 2023, went snowboarding up in Whistler for a couple of weeks in Canada, and it was just gorgeous. And I was coming back to this really high profile within, I guess, preset surgical trainers in Sydney, at least a very niche area, a high profile position at RPA, being the advanced gastrointestinal SRMO for the RPA colorectal department, which is a really well-respected position that, again, is selective. And I was really proud of myself that I got that position. And after coming back from Canada, you know, I had like 2 days to set myself up to starting that job, which was, you know, incredible and amazing experience. And then I found a couple of months in, I was just exhausted. I was really, really, really tired. And I think that tiredness didn't come from me not liking the job. It just came from the demands of the job, and not only the demands of the day-to-day, but the demands of the after-hours roster that I was a part of at the hospital, where we were short-staffed, and there were a lot of, we had to all had to pitch in to pick up a lot of extra shifts, changing, for example, from night shifts to day shifts, which I know isn't a unique experience as a junior medical officer, but I was just really, really tired. That led me to reaching out to some really close friends and family. And one of my really good mates suggested I go to my GP and talk about it. And I have this fabulous GP, which I highly recommend everyone find, otherwise it's really difficult. And in that GP appointment, my GP really teased out what was going on. And she said, you know, maybe you should think about career coaching. Maybe you should think about getting some external help to think through these career and life decisions and goals and how to really marry up where I wanted to go. And so my GP referred me on to a medical careers coach, and she also started, which is quite intimidating for me, to be on my first ever mental health care plan, and referred me to a psychologist, which I never ever thought that I would need, as well as probably most importantly signing a medical certificate for me to have some time off work to work through that. And I think that was, yeah, the start of the wobble showing its symptoms, I suppose, and starting to make me realize that you can't ignore those little voices that build up inside, and it's really important to listen to them and to get the help that you need.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because it's so true. We can, I think, as doctors, we can be really good at ignoring the voices and kind of putting them down. But then it comes to a point, right, where it's impossible to ignore. So thank you for sharing your moment where you did need extra support. So you saw a career coach, and this has sparked a career shift, which is quite a big shift. You know, I think most people be like, surgery to med admin, you know, what was behind that change?
I think, what really helped me think through all of those career and life issues that had sort of been this nebulous kind of floating thought bubble in my head, seeing that career coach really kind of helped me synthesize those thoughts into potential actions. I found it really useful to talk with, you know, an external person about all of the things I had been thinking about. So I know that there's various different styles of career coaching out there, but the one that I used, she looked through my CV, I did a personality test, and then we had an interview together where she spent a long time, you know, teasing out those sort of nebulous kind of thought bubbles I had, thinking about my priorities. And she was actually the first one who introduced me to the idea of medical administration as a profession. I think not very many people know that it's an option. You know, and at the time, you know, as I previously mentioned, I've always been interested in big picture, wicked complex problems with lots of moving parts, and, you know, there's so many of them in the hospital. And when I was, you know, wondering where my life was headed, I had thought about going back to the public service and, you know, stepping outside of, I guess, a specific medical role completely and just going back to public service, either federal or state government. And the career coach said, you know, rather than step out of medicine, medical administration is actually a really good potential pathway to link all of those skills together, and to use my background prior to medicine within my medical career. And I think that really helped me think about, you know, I'd always seen myself getting back to management, leadership, policy, problem-solving role eventually, but through surgery, you know, after doing surgical training, getting head of department roles, building up my expertise in management, etc. And my career coach said, by showing me this pathway of medical admin, made me realize that it was possible for me to just get straight there rather than taking this, you know, convoluted path through surgery. And I guess that helped. One of the other things I was going through at the time when I had the career coach was, and seeing a psychologist, my partner, who thankfully doesn't work in medicine, he was offered a job in New York, and we were trying to figure out how I could move to New York and maintain a career in medicine, or move to New York and move out of medicine and get a job in, you know, a drug company with my science background or private insurance or something. And I think the one key question that the advisor asked me was, why are you willing to throw away your career in surgery to go to New York, but you're not willing to consider changing your career in surgery for your own mental health? And I think hearing the choice phrased like that really made me think, wait a sec, you know, again, reflecting, what's important to me? What do I really want to get out of my life? And yeah, as I also mentioned, it took a long time to come to that decision, and I still went through the surgical selection process in parallel with going through the medical administration process, and again reached out to lots of different people to find out more about medical admin that not a whole lot of people know about. But thankfully, my mentors through surgery were quite supportive, or really supportive actually, and helped me reach out to people who they knew in that management and leadership space to help guide me through that process.
That's great that you had that support from your mentors in surgery, and that you got that kind of outside perspective to help link all your experiences and interests together and priorities. So you're now in med admin, you applied to both, you chose med admin. Did you get any unsolicited advice throughout this change? How did you navigate that, if you did?
I think I didn't really get too much unsolicited advice because I asked for it in a lot of ways. I had a bunch of core people who knew what I was thinking about and knew that I was, firstly, knew that I had my wobbles or burnout or fell in a big hole, whatever you want to call it. You know, obviously I was absent from the hospital for a period of time. And I had colleagues at work, you know, friends and family also helping me. I guess I kind of controlled that on purpose, because I was quite worried about what people would think. You know, surgeons are interesting personalities, most of them lovely, I have to say. I didn't have any, you know, personality clashes or, thankfully, any horrible experiences that changed my decision. But I was just really careful about who I spoke to and who I sought advice from and who knew what I was up to, because I was concerned about that backlash of, you know, in the middle of the clinical year, thinking about doing something different, having people say, oh, well, you don't want to do surgery, so why are you in theatre, when being in theatre was my favourite place in the world. And I was really worried, probably in retrospect, too worried about what people thought of me, but I was really careful about managing who knew what I was up to.
Yeah, that's really great advice. And I think it's something that is really useful for when you do have a change or an idea that to protect who you tell it to, and be selective. You don't have to tell every single person.
Yeah. It's really hard because I'm generally quite an open person, and I'm really terrible at keeping my own secrets. But I think in order to protect myself, I had to. And again, that was the advice that I was getting from people much more senior than me as well, was to just, you know, hold my cards close to my chest and not lie to people, because I'm also a terrible liar and I just can't, but not, you know, tell the world. And I think, you know, not everyone's interested in what you're doing anyway. Don't listen. Sometimes there's no point saying anything. But yeah, I guess I was quite careful.
Yeah, that is true. Sometimes most people aren't really concerned. They're concerned with what they're doing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and what you think people care about and think about you is like so often not true anyway. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now you also have big news. You are pregnant, and not just pregnant with twins.
Yes.
So congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you share more on this? How are you juggling medicine, so your Rakma training and motherhood?
Yep. It's all very new. Just made it into my second trimester. So very exciting. The nausea has been intense. How am I juggling it? I guess, again, you know, as with any new pregnancy, it's overwhelming at times, it's scary at times, it's exciting at times. And I was also, again, very selective about who I told what was going on. It was kind of made easier, I guess, in that I had 3 weeks leave at the end of the clinical year this time to go to Japan to go snowboarding. And I found out I was pregnant just the day before we left to go to Japan, and then came back from Japan the day before I started my new rotation in my new job, in my new career pathway. So I kind of didn't, you know, really have that many opportunities for at least colleagues at work to figure out what was going on. So again, I was quite selective with who I told what was happening. But now that I'm in my new workplace, you know, I work at the medical council in quite a small team. My two closest colleagues are female GPs by training, who have now moved into more administrative type jobs with the council. And I knew that they would both guess what was going on from their own training. And of course they did, and told me when I told them that they already kind of had figured it out. So I'm really lucky. I've got a really supportive partner, who's, you know, with me 100% the whole way. And we're figuring out how training will change, how my career will change, who takes maternity and paternity leave when, all of those things are still in motion and a bit up in the air. But again, I'm really lucky to have some really good mentors and senior people around me helping me at work, and as well, I was super lucky to have great friends and family, both inside and outside of medicine, helping me along as well.
That's great that you have that support. It's a recurrent theme. Mm. I see that, you know, the importance of support through all the stages.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious, are you going to move to New York?
No,
okay. That's not happening.
Yeah. Again, with my very supportive partner, we decided that things were a bit too tricky to navigate in the American medical system for me until I get a fellowship. You're sitting the US MLE and starting again, for example, is a big step. You know, I spoke to someone who did anesthetics, wanted to do anesthetics training in the US, and it took them just 4 years to do the prep work to even get a first year job in the US. So in speaking to my partner, and again, our life goals about wanting to have children, et cetera, decided that we'll put the New York stuff sadly on hold. Potentially until I get my fellowship and then reconsider things from there.
Yeah, fair enough. Things have changed now.
Massively
changed. And I also wanted to ask a bit more about fertility. Fertility as a woman working in medicine, because I know you have your own journey through this. Can you share more on that?
I think as a female in any modern profession, fertility and family is something that a lot of us think about or decide not to think about with making conscious and conscientious decisions. My first kind of real thoughts about fertility was, I think, as a medical student when I was in second year. I think we were doing our endocrine term or block or whatever they call it. And we had a fertility doctor come in from one of the IVF companies. And she said, okay, ladies, you know, something along the lines of, okay, ladies, if you've got no man, if you've got no plan, then you have to freeze your eggs. And I remember just sitting there being like, what? Like, why is she telling us this? And, you know, I was in my late 20s. And I was like, no, I'll be fine. I've got heaps of time. Like, you know, I had a partner at the time, different one to now, but who I thought, you know, things would just naturally head that way. And I was like, no, what's she talking about? I've got plenty of time. I'll be fine. And then, you know, through the last years of medical school and through moving to Sydney, setting up my career again, focusing on getting all of my things in line for my set application and just concentrating on working, I'd kind of put all those fertility and goals and ideas about being a mum to the side and thought, no, that, you know, let's concentrate on your career. And then a couple of years ago in 2022, I think as part of that process of really thinking about where I was headed and what my goals were, started thinking about fertility again. And that's when I thought back to this no man, no plan, freeze your eggs statement from the fertility doctor. And at that stage, I had no man, I had no plan, and I was like, okay, I've got to freeze my eggs. So again, went to my GP, got the relevant referrals to the fertility specialist and went through the process of freezing my eggs, which was expensive again. Not as expensive as I thought, but it was expensive. But the actual process was very easy for me, luckily. I know it's different for lots of different women, but I found it easier than I expected. And my only regret at the time was that I hadn't done it sooner. As a lot of your medical listeners will know, fertility only decreases as you get old. And here I'm 38 now. No, I'm 37 now. Oh, gee.
You added a year.
Oh, no, don't do that. I turned 38 this year. You know, I was 35 at the time when sort of the fertility really starts to decline. And my only regret in some ways about doing the egg freezing was that I didn't do it earlier. But then I met the great person who I'm with today. And I think when you get to my age, when you meet someone who you click with, you just know that they're going to be your person and you're not scared of making really big decisions and making really big choices together. So I guess reasonably quickly we decided we wanted to have babies together, which
plural.
One of the first times I've actually like said this out loud. It's quite a lot. And yeah, thankfully it all happened very quickly after we decided to go for it. Happened much quicker than either of us expected, and haven't ended up needing to use those eggs that I have frozen. They're still sitting there, haven't used them. I'm still paying for their storage fees, but I haven't actually used them. But it's kind of, I found after I had those eggs sitting there waiting, it was just a big relief that I hadn't realized that I was carrying around that nagging question about my fertility, and that I almost, you know, they call it an insurance policy against your fertility, which some ways I don't really agree with that, but in others it was helpful, I think, to know that that option is there if I needed it, even though I haven't. But yeah, it's fascinating. Fertility, babies, seeing them on yes. the ultrasound. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. And, yeah. and to freeze or not to freeze the eggs is a big question. I think for a lot of people, and for those listening, I do have an episode about that with Dr. Violet Q, who's a fertility specialist, and we speak all about this, you know, when to freeze your eggs, what age, and it's great to get informed, right, and to think about it.
Yeah, I think it's such an individual decision for everybody. You know, everyone has their different reasons to consider fertilization. To consider egg donation and freezing and to go down that IVF pathway. But I think, you know, information is like so key, and listening to the people you trust talking about it, as well as listening to peers who have been through it before, was really important and helpful for me too.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. And now you're on RACMA training. Mm-hmm. How are things for you now? How is it?
It's very different to my hospital life. I mean, as I mentioned, I have no regrets making the decision. I can see now, which I potentially didn't quite appreciate when I was going through the application process, how my previous experience in an office environment doing, you know, desk work has helped me transition into the career. Still very early days, you know, only like a month and a half into my training. I'm loving it. I think the biggest, most obvious change is the change to my working hours. I do, you know, business hours 8 to 4 at a desk with a lunch break. And all of those things are foreign to a lot of my colleagues still in the hospital system. You know, the little things like having a working computer that connects to a keyboard and a mouse and a printer every day, I think is something that I certainly don't take for granted after being in the hospital system.
Oh, 100%.
Yes. I think the other difference is, as I mentioned, I work with quite a small team, and my supervisor, who will be my supervisor for the year of my training, is sitting in the office right next to me, and having that not constant supervision but constant interaction with my supervisor, I think is quite different to sometimes how the hospital system works as well. Learning a whole lot of new things. So in my job at the Medical Council of New South Wales, we manage the complaints that come through the system from members of the public, often patients or representatives, as well as complaints from other doctors, including mandatory notifications and complaints from LHDs where they're concerned about a practitioner or they've got disciplinary action against a practitioner, for example. We get about over 3,000 complaints per year. So it's a lot of complaints, and some of it can be quite confronting. And some really bad behaviour out there, which is, I think, you're somewhat protected from, particularly in what I was. Can't speak for everyone in the hospital system, but yeah, it's given me a really interesting perspective on what doctors in Australia are dealing with. And you know, for example, I manage complaints that come in from all sorts of different specialties, and it's sometimes, you know, making me draw back to my, you know, things I haven't heard from medical school, like Guillain-Barré syndrome. And like, hang on, what a sec. Wait, I learned that at some point. so it's interesting drawing on obviously my medical, clinical knowledge, stuff I hadn't even thought about since medical school, as well as that office work dealing with multiple different stakeholders. We work a lot with APRA, the HCCC, the pharmacy regulators as well, and that stakeholder management, clinical medicine knowledge is really coming together for me. But my role at the medical council is quite different to a lot of other registrar training jobs in medical administration. Like, most of them are based at the hospital under a director of medical services, for example. So I'm really keen to, you know, get experience in those different areas of med admin as well.
Okay, cool. So you can change between the different areas in your training, or?
Yeah, so the way that the RACMA fellowship training program is set up, it's 3 years. Or you have to do 3 years to be eligible to sit the exit exam at the end. So it's a minimum of 3 years. And you are allocated, once you're accepted onto the program, you're then allocated a job for a year within the training network. And the majority of people, it's done this way, allocated a job within the training network. So, for example, the New South Wales jurisdiction looks after me and my New South Wales colleagues for the year, and then you then reapply, re-interview for positions for the following year. And there's right. a candidate preferencing and matching process that occurs after CVs and interviews. There is this alternate pathway where people outside of that system can also apply to the fellowship training program if they have an accredited position that lies outside of that. But in the main, it's a centralized recruitment process year on year.
And yeah, I was just going to ask, do you have to do like a master's in administration or anything to apply?
So again, as a lot of the medical colleges do, they like to shift their requirements for not only getting into training but while you're on training. And the College of Medical Administration is undergoing a review of their training program at the moment. So until this year, it was compulsory to do a master's in a related field. Most people choose a master's in medical administration or health administration and leadership, which is the master's that I'm enrolled in at UNSW. But from this year, they're changing it. Instead of having to do a full master's, you only need to do, you can choose to only instead do a set of core subjects instead of the whole master's to then meet the criteria to be eligible to exit the program with fellowship.
Oh, yeah, that's good to know. Again, I think
goes back to that keeping your eye on mm-hmm. the college requirements and what's changing.
Oh yeah, and that's for every college. That's what
absolutely.
Every time you look, it's like, oh, this is new from when I last.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I know we're nearing the end of time. I have a few more questions. If you're okay with that,
Okay, great. Yeah. Sorry if I'm talking too much.
No. It's all good. We're almost near the end. What would you say to a colleague who has not gotten onto the surgical program of their choice and is maybe trying for their second or third time?
Gosh, keep trying. firstly, it's really easy to take the rejection of not getting on the first time as a personal affront and to think I'm not good enough in so many different ways, which is really difficult self-talk to stop. and I don't feel like overly qualified to be able to give this advice, but I guess reaching out to people when you're having those low moments and doubting yourself is really important. But also trying not to doubt yourself, try and be pragmatic about it. You know, sit down, look at your CV, and figure out where those points are missing. For me, for example, I realized I could get some more points in both the teaching and publication criteria of my particular program. And so I reached out to the mentors and the people who I thought would be able to help me, who then put me in touch again with further people who would be able to help me make sure I met that criteria. Mm-hmm. So I think trying not to like panic and get too sad's probably the wrong word, but get too like
defeated.
Yeah, don't get too defeated about it, and then instead think about it pragmatically and be like, okay, that happened, how can I do better next time? And I found that by, you know, coming to my supervisors from that perspective of feel like I'm not good enough, can you help me be good enough, was probably more productive than just being like, I'm not good enough, I'll walk away.
Right.
But I know that a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to get onto training programs. And I know for me that listening to that little voice in my head saying, maybe this wasn't the right thing for me, was really important as well. But I still was quite pragmatic about how I approached it, and still ended up following through with applying for the training program, even though I wasn't 100% sure that's what I wanted to do. And I think I found that really useful, because then when I was offered my set place, a telling moment for me that made me realize, wait a sec, what are you doing, was my overwhelming emotion when I was offered that position was, oh, now it's my choice. Now I get to make the decision.
Yeah.
And that was really powerful, and in some ways overrode all of those previous feelings I had of I'm not good enough, because all of a sudden I was good enough and I was able to make those choices for myself. And I think because I was pragmatic about that, and the advice both from my psychologist and my career coach and a bunch of other people was to just keep going, so that it was my decision to make in the end, and it made me have the power to control where I was going.
Yeah, that is powerful that you could make the choice between the two. And that you were, like you said, pragmatic. So though you had that voice telling you this isn't for you, you spoke to people, you got your information, and then you made your choice.
Yeah, I guess I was quite lucky in a way that I did have the choice, but I also worked my butt off to get there, to have those choices, and
yes,
made sure I was getting advice from the right people.
Yeah, exactly. You were doing the actions to get the information and choices that you got. And what would you say to an aspiring surgical trainee who may be reconsidering their direction?
I think, again, listen to that voice that's talking to you saying maybe it's not right. You know, as we touched on, a career in surgery is long, or the training for a career in surgery is long and demanding, as is most specialties in medicine, if not all. They're all demanding in their own different ways, but, you know, surgery has a reputation for being demanding and taking a lot from you for a reason. And I think it's just important to make sure that those reasons really align with your goals. I think one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was back from when I was working with the government, actually, considering going into medicine. One of my friends said, it doesn't have to be easy, it just has to be worth it. And I think reflecting back on what's worth it for you is really important, because what's worth it for one person isn't what's worth it for other people. And yes, surgery is amazing. Being in the operating theatre is amazing. Being called the surgeons in the hospital is amazing. But it doesn't have to be everything. And I think that And I genuinely think that surgery is amazing. I'm just saying. But I think for me, I realized that it's not in the end really where I was going. And I think interestingly, when I did finally open up to people about my change in career, the overwhelming response that I got from people was, wow, that's brave. In a good way. And I think don't be afraid to be brave. And it was kind of, yeah, it was interesting that that was the response that I got from people because it's not what I expected.
It is brave. That's beautiful as well. Don't be afraid to be brave. And it's also brave to come on and speak about it and share it publicly. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome. Pleasure.
What is balance to you?
Gosh, unachievable. I think balance is about managing expectations and thinking about what's genuinely achievable in whatever time is available, whatever resources you have available. And, yeah, everyone says you have to have a work-life balance. That means so many different things to so many different people. And for some people, their work-life balance is spending, you know, 7 days a week in the hospital and eating at home once a week is fine for them. But for me, I think balance is doing what I do at work well and being proud of the efforts that I put into my work, but not letting it be everything about me and not letting it define who I am, which in some ways I think I was letting my professional personality take over my life personality in some ways through what I went through. But I feel now, partly because potentially because my work hours are better, I've got a better balance between my professional personality and my personality outside of medicine. Spending time getting back to the exercise that I, you know, love as a kid. When I made this choice to start this new career this year, I was really excited about the opportunity to get back to going rowing in the morning. And then having twins cooking away in my belly has kind of put that on the back burner again. But yeah, I think that balance of work and life outside of work is really important. And I'm really relishing the extra free time I have to connect with my friends and family.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I'm sure after all those long working weeks, you can really relish the time even more now. Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add that you think would benefit the listeners?
I guess trying to listen to myself talk, I've used the word support networks or support people a lot. And I think only now that I've articulated that do I realize how useful that support has been. And I think one of the most telling examples was when I talked to my surgical mentor, one of my closest surgical mentors, about my change in career. I said to her, you know, that I was really worried about telling her that I was going to leave surgery because I didn't want her to think that in all of the years she had spent helping me get onto the SET program, I didn't want her to think that she had wasted her time helping me and wasted her time training me. And that's what I perhaps naively expected her reaction to be. But when I told her that I was leaving, she said, you know, of course I don't think I've wasted my time. She said that she saw her role not as making me another version of her, but was helping me to become whatever version of myself I wanted to be. And those are really powerful words. Made me cry at the time. I guess just stressing the importance of building that base of people around you, which is sometimes not easy, and only on reflecting at times like this and articulating that pathway do I really realize how important all those people have been.
Wow, what an amazing mentor, those words.
She's incredible. Very grateful to have her around.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Are you happy for people to reach out to you if they wanted to, maybe another surgical trainee wanting to change or in a position similar?
Yeah, absolutely happy to help. Again, I don't think I'm an expert in this area, and I think that I haven't necessarily done things the right way or the correct way, but happy to help if anyone thinks I can give them some tips or advice for sure.
Yeah, that sounds good. So I'll put my email in the show notes, and then if you're interested, I can get you in contact with Pip, who's generously open to this. Thank you again for coming on. It's been so great to chat.
My pleasure. Thanks again for the invite. Yeah, it's been really good, and in some ways has made me reflect a bit more on how I got here too, which is kind of, weird in some ways.
Yeah, I'm glad you got that. Yeah, that's a bonus, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You've been listening to the Balance Medics Handover Podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, I'd love for you to take a minute to rate and review this podcast and click the follow button. For more resources, check out the Balance Medics website. The link to this will be in the show notes below. See you next episode.